Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the two-part class, Opera 101. I'd like to welcome to the program award-winning journalist Mohammed Omer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Mohammed.
Oh, thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So you have been on the ground in Cairo for the last several days. Tell us what you've seen of the protests going on in Egypt.
Well, the protests are still going on until the moment as I speak. In Cairo, it's quite a big mess here because of the anti-government protest, which is going on mainly in Cairo, but also in different parts of the country. The crowds are demanding the end of the President Mubarak regime, and they are calling for three different slogans. Most of them, they are calling for the end of the role of President Mubarak. It seems that there is less satisfaction coming out of the speech of President Mubarak 2 days ago, as he ordered the government to resign, and he promised to improve the living of the Egyptians. These promises did not translate much improvement on the ground for many Egyptians. People are still on the roads. There is quite a lot of riots and theft attacks targeting public properties and schools, banks, markets, and buildings. Four of the main prisons in Egypt have been attacked by a number of clans, and many of the prisoners have managed to flee the prisons. I've been told by Egyptian officials that hundreds of prisoners who managed to flee, there is at least 40 to 50 of those who are classified as dangerous criminals to the Egyptian public. Today, the riot police has came back to the ground and in order to be able to stop the people who are protesting. The situation as it is now is still getting worse and worse by the day, because the number of people in the middle of Cairo at the Tahrir Square are increasing, and we don't know if this is going to continue for the coming hours or if it's going to continue for the coming weeks. But I have talked to a number of the demonstrators, and I've been told that they are going to continue to protest until their demands are met. And the demand of the different groups is bread, freedom, and social justice, things that have been missing for the last 26 years as President Mubarak is in the office. There is a lot of concerns internationally about citizens, like countries like Australia, South Korea, United States, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and England. They have all called their citizens to leave Egypt immediately. For example, Australia is scheduling couple of flights to leave on Wednesday to evacuate our Australian nationals. United States have managed today to evacuate around 1,200 Americans who are mostly in Cairo and in different parts of Egypt. The United States of America have decided that one more crowd is going to leave in the coming few days. Tomorrow, I have been told by official sources that there will be 1,500 Americans who are leaving on six airplanes back to the United States. Saudi Arabia has followed the same method by calling their nationals together and embassy, and we're taking all in shuttles to the airport. Turkey and England are going to try to do the same. Let me say here that there is about 50,000 Americans who are living in Cairo and in different Egyptian cities. Those are the ones who are registered in the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. And the call is from the State Department and from the U.S. Embassy is to immediately call on nationals who carry the American nationality to leave Cairo and go back to the United States.
Mohammed, you've been talking to a lot of people in Egypt and asking them this question: what is the role of the United States? In other words, can the U.S. do anything to help at this point? What have people been telling you?
I have been asking a number of people if they think that the United States can do anything. There seems to be an agreement by public that United States or any other country can do nothing to improve the conditions of Egyptians. The problem is Egyptian, and the solution should be Egyptian, as I have been told by a 38-year-old man who's telling me that this is what is going to happen. And what we want is only a free and transparent election in Egypt, and we are going to vote for the ones that we want. Nothing more, nothing less. He said that Egypt is capable to provide all the support for its citizens, and we are not expecting any help from abroad. What we want is more pressure from abroad on President Mubarak to make sure that election take place. And most important, as many of the crowds are talking about, they are saying that they want the leadership, and mainly the President Mubarak, to leave office right now. One of those that I met is a student in Cairo at Al-Tahrir Square, and I asked him what is it that he is trying to achieve. It's a quite chilly night, and I'm trying to figure out what he wanted to do, really, in the coming days. He said he's going to remain in the road protesting until the President Mubarak is out of office, which means there is a lot of crowds who are really very eager to get President Mubarak out of office. They believe this is the only way to improve the lives of many of the Egyptians. Let us mention Mayor Charlotte here, that this is not the only protest. There has been a number of protests, perhaps not to the larger scale as of today, and perhaps they were not as violent as today. Over 100 people were killed in this protest and the clashes, and over 1,000 were injured, and this is still going on. In 86 and in 88, there was a number of protests calling for the government to raise the wages of employees. The government did manage to shut down these demonstrations, mostly by force. Unfortunately, the government is able to crack down on the protesters and to make sure that their voices are unheard. One of the things that has been quite scary is the targeting of media personnel working in Egypt. And this was one of the most major problems. Many of the colleagues who were attacked by the raid police of Egypt, and they were attacked by the intelligence services and the security establishment in Egypt, simply because they were carrying cameras and trying to provide image of what's happening in Egypt. As we all know, there has been also blocking of Twitter and Facebook and the telecommunication. Sending text messages is not possible because the Egyptian government have managed to block all means of communication for a number of hours. I have been told by a number of Egyptian officials that it is because of pressure from European countries, the Egyptian government allowed Vodafone to operate in Egypt, and the same goes also on social media like Facebook and Twitter. One of the things that were quite surprising in this protest is army coming down on the road, and this is something that is not common in a matter of a protest in Egypt. Egypt had a history, as I've said, and most of these history is really related to riot police who would handle this type of events. This time, the President Mubarak has called on the Egyptian army to get down on the street. There wasn't any type of clashes between the army. The Egyptian army has been very well received by the protesters. In fact, we could see people who were hugging and kissing the army officers on the streets. That was just a quite normal relationship, and there was no type of clashes recorded as far as I'm concerned. Let us mention here that Egypt has army of 500,000 members, and it is known to be one of the 10th ranking on the world, and the Egyptian government gets $1.3 billion as military aid to the Egyptian army from the United States of America. We have seen also a number of F-16s hovering over Cairo. Nobody knows what is these F-16s meant to be. Are they supposed to be a symbol of support to the public, or are they supposed to be to separate those who are protesting? There hasn't been any official communication. What is the significance? The significance of this type of F-16s hovering over the sky of Cairo. I can tell that the situation is going to escalate in the coming few days. Despite the chilly weather and the rain, people are still indeed insisting that they want to remain on the ground and to keep protesting until the president is outside of the office. There is a huge number of demands that people are making, but most of the demands I can summarize in three words: the bread, freedom, and social justice. Anyone who is protesting would agree with these three categories. People are calling for improvement of life. I met with some of those people who were telling me, we are having a big problem of not being able to feed our families. One of those that I met is telling me that he's working in a factory. All he gets is 300 pounds, he said, per month. And the 300 Egyptian pounds is not enough to feed his family when 1 kilo of meat costs 60 pounds. He said, if I want to buy 2 kilos of meat once a month, how am I going to manage for the rest of the month? He is demanding that the government should indeed give the legitimate rights and demands of the Egyptian people and to improve the conditions and to alleviate poverty and to make life possible for people who are living under poverty line.
We're talking to Mohamed Omer. Mohamed, tell us more about how journalists have been treated during these protests.
Some of the colleagues and journalists were arrested, some others were injured, some others, their equipment were confiscated. One of the things which is quite disturbing to me is to see the riot police is not differentiating between anybody. The moment they see a cameraman, then they start all attacking the cameraman and beating the cameraman up and taking their equipment or arresting them. Al Jazeera was one of the stations which was shot by the Egyptian government. A number of journalists were attacked, including a colleague of mine who was severely injured after he was beaten up by the riot police in Cairo. He was taken for 6 hours as a hostage. And there has been a lot of trouble, basically, when it comes to freedom of expression. Journalists are having a very difficult time in getting the message out. That's the physical violence. Then also there is other type of violence, which you can see in blocking the internet and making it possible to file stories. It's impossible to file stories for people who are working on the ground simply because the communication has been down, and filing photos seems to be a very difficult thing in these past few days. I can tell there is an increasing number of journalists who are arriving despite all the trouble, which is quite positive. There is a lot of demand from the international media, a lot of interest from the international media to see what's happening and to open the eyes of the public. I can see that many of the journalists who were attacked, like the Guardian correspondent, the BBC World Service correspondent, who were brutally attacked during their work. And I don't see this is going to change anytime soon. I have seen a number of riot police who are specifically attacking journalists, and some are even using a very excessive aggression on media crew and cameramen in order to make sure that they stop broadcasting images live from Egypt on the ground.
Before Facebook and Twitter and the internet were shut down, to what extent were they used as an organizing tool in the protests?
Yeah, well, let's say here that there has been one of the things that is quite prominent, and that all the lobbying and advocacy of these groups, most of those who are protesting on the roads are youth. They are the young generation, the young Egyptians, and many of them are motivated by social media. Facebook and Twitter was used as a mean for the protests. They are spreading the word. Like this evening, there is more messages coming out from the protesters that tomorrow it's going to be a demonstration for 1 million who are going to be standing at Al-Tahrir Square in the center of Cairo. So I can confirm that the social media has been used very effectively to demonstrate and to protest. Many of those around the world who cannot be in Egypt are also protesting by joining groups on Facebook and Twitter and spreading the news, which is traveling as much or as fast as possible. I would expect that if the Egyptian government would let social media be free, I would expect the number of protesters to increase and possibly to spread into other cities, which has been, up to this moment, relatively calm in different parts across the country.
In Cairo, are people able to eat? Is there food in the stores? Are there shortages? What are the basic conditions of daily life look like?
Well, it differs from one place to another. I have seen a very aggressive behavior of customers running to the stores trying to buy food because they think that this crisis is just going to make things. The panic which explains this kind of aggressive customer behavior, who are running to the shops trying to buy things that they could find on the way, it is something to do with one thing, and that is those people are afraid that the curfew is going to continue. The curfew which is imposed by the Egyptian government on people from 3 o'clock until 8 in the morning is going to be a very, very longer one. So many of the people are running to buy food and to get water and to get the supplies that they need. There is availability of food, there is availability of supplies, but most of the shops have been closed, and there is a strike, which means many of the shops have been closed. There's a lot of riots that many of the shop owners cannot afford to be open during the hours which is allowed people to walk in the cities. That is simply because there has been a number of attacks on crowds and shops, and many of these shops, they prefer to be shut because when the riot police have withdrawn from the streets, there is a number of riots which you can see across the country, a number of groups who are attacking the different stores, the different markets, the different banks. Banks are not working today, stores are not working today. Most of the city is nearly closed simply because the situation is very difficult and it is not possible for many of those Egyptians to be able to get the materials they need because there is a fear to be able to leave your house because many of those fear that their houses will be robbed. One of the things why is this robbery or theft attacks are increasing, it is explained through a number of clans who attacked four of the prisons, four of the main Egyptian prisons, where at least hundreds of the prisoners fled the prisons. About 30 to 40 are classified as dangerous criminals, and those people who are in charge of many of the theft attacks on banks, stores, and government buildings in Cairo and the other cities.
We're talking to Mohamed Omer. You said a moment ago that most of the people out there protesting are young people. Tell us more about these people, what their lives are like. Is it men and women? Is it only men? Who are they?
There is men and women, mostly students and intellectuals. What is adding to this protest, it's different that the young generation who are running the engine of this protest. Most of them are men and women, students, intellectuals, academics, and different parts of the Egyptians. You find a lot of different groups within Egypt who are protesting on the roads, and most of those groups are calling for reform and social justice. These groups are supporting a number of alternatives to President Mubarak. You can see the large crowd at Al Tahrir Square yesterday during the speech of Mohammed al-Baradi, who is one of the supporters of this protest in Cairo. All the young men and women around him are supporting him, and many are trying to propose him as the next president of Egypt. Mohammed al-Baradi is one of the names that came out as one of the trusted names to be a president if the president Mubarak is to resign in the next few days. Another name is Mohammed Badir, who is from the Muslim Brotherhood, and he is the founder of Al-Ghad Party. There is also Ayman Noor, and then there is also Hamdan Sabahi, who are both being motivated by young generation to go for presidency. All things are still holding because so far the president of Egypt seems to be standing and he is not ready to step down. The demands of the people and the public here is that the president should get out of here. Like I can tell you, one of the banners of those people who are holding the banners, one was telling Mubarak, "Mubarak, game is over. Get out now." And some others, they are writing, some bosses telling Mubarak to join the president of Tunisia in Saudi Arabia. It's time for you to join him, and all those corrupt leaders will just go there and be kicked out. There is a huge number of protesters who are quite aggressive and quite angry. Many of those protesters as well are quite progressive, that they do not want to see the country in a mess. Like they have taken voluntary positions to control the traffic and to control and to police the situation and to take care of the different security issues. You find a lot of those people are trying to make sure that there is less chaos. The army is helping to arrest some of those who are trying to cause chaos, but I don't think the Egyptian army is very much trained to chase those people who are trying to cause riots. Most of the protesters are indeed using a very peaceful way of demonstrating, but those who are trying to invade and attack buildings and theft attacks on different places, including banks and the stores, they are those who fled from the prisons, and it's not possible to control them unless the police is back on the road. We are expecting in the next few hours police to come on the road again, but will this mean that there will be a new wave of protest and attacks, perhaps more violent attacks and confrontation between riots, police and protesters? It's possible. It's the only coming hours that will show what will happen.
We're talking to Mohamed Omer. What have you seen outside of Cairo?
Well, outside of Cairo, it's not so much different. It's mostly the same thing as it is in Cairo and outside. When I went to Al Ismailia, which is just around about 2-3 hours drive from Cairo, it's the same situation, basically. Protests and riots and a lot of mess on the roads. Many of those people who are not Egyptian nationals are trying to leave the country for their safety. There has been a number of violent attacks in Sinai, for example. I crossed the desert and I was able to see a number of the Bedouin clans. Many of those Bedouin clans are attacking the police stations, bombing the police stations, and they all hope to release their relatives who are detained in the Egyptian prisons. They did succeed to blow up one of the state security headquarters, which is about 2 hours from Sinai. And this has caused a lot of problems, that the state security is considered to be one of the main ones, which is indeed helping the majority of people to maintain security in the region. Until today, I can tell that the international road, which is connecting the different cities between Sinai and Al Ismailia and Cairo, is indeed blocked by a number of riots. Families and the clans and Bedouin families who are there with quite heavy armament and weapons, and they are stopping everybody they could find in the way. It's not possible to get around without being harassed by those. And being a journalist in these areas is always a big question. But even for local Egyptians, it is very difficult to move around simply because these families or these riots, I could say these Bedouin clans, what they're trying to do is to take advantage of the system and to release their prisoners. And some of them are trying to control the traffic. But I'm afraid in Sinai area, this is a little bit less organized than it is in Cairo. And that has something to do with the fact that there isn't very much education opportunities for people living in Sinai. We don't know what is going to happen in the coming few hours, but I do see that the crisis is going to continue, because I know even in Sinai, most of those people in Sinai are just saying, hey, we are not going to end this now. We are going to keep protesting until we get rid of Mubarak. But then there is no ideas of what is the alternative of Mubarak, and if there will be any suggestions for free elections. And I can say that many of the peoples are going to continue to protest in the next few days and perhaps weeks.
Mohammed, what is the role of public opinion from other Middle Eastern countries, from the European Union, and from the rest of the world in this stage of Egypt's history, do you think?
Well, let me start by the United States of America. There was Mrs. Hillary Clinton who said that the United States is supporting the Egyptian people's right to protest. However, following the speech of President Mubarak, Mrs. Clinton said that President Mubarak did not do enough for the people of Egypt. There has been a number of messages to President Mubarak from Saudi Arabia, from United Kingdom, from Turkey, and from other countries. And there has been only concerns. Many of the European countries, mostly in Italy and Austria, they have called on the Egyptian government to allow Facebook and Twitter. Italy, for example, has called on Egypt to have self-control on the ground. There isn't very much that many of these countries have offered. Even the neighbor countries haven't offered much, apart from expressing that Egyptians do really have the right to express their needs and demands and to protest peacefully. There has been, I can say, a concern from the Egyptian government, followed by a concern by the Israeli government. Israel said that the Egyptian government is getting a number of tanks and army vehicles close to Sinai, and this is a violation to the Camp David agreement signed between Egypt and Israel. They say that if this is going to continue, it's going to represent a violation, though Israel admit that they do understand the need for such a move in order to control the crowds. Apart from that, there isn't very much really reactions coming out. It's only to support the public opinion and to support the public of Egyptians. But nobody knows really when and how and in what form this type of protest is going to end. There is expectation that it might take some few weeks before the demands of the protesters are met and the President Mubarak is outside his office. But then many of those people who are concerned, they are asking, well, is that what we want? President Mubarak outside of the office? And they are trying to find an alternative. President Mubarak has provoked the public by inviting Omar Suleiman, who is the chief of intelligence in Egypt, to be the vice president. Many of the Egyptians say the problem is not inventing new characters, because we know those characters and we don't want them anymore. And we are not going to abide to the new government, because people want to have their own election and to have a new leadership, and the changing of names will not help to improve the situation, because many of those people on the ground are simply looking forward for the day when they have a free election and President Mubarak is out of office and they are able to decide on who they want to represent them and who they want to work to improve the living conditions of many of the people in Egypt.
Mohammed, anything else?
I want to confirm here that the U.S., that the Army of Egypt has just confirmed that we are not going to use any types of violence at all. And one thing that, as a comment to the concern of Israel, Israel has told Egypt that it is okay for the Egyptian government to increase the number of Egyptian soldiers close to Sinai in order to control the chaos in the area, which means there will be 800 more soldiers who are coming right on the ground. in the coming few hours to control the crowds of the Bedouin families.
Mohamed Omer is an award-winning journalist reporting to us from Egypt, and we hope to talk to you later on this week. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're welcome.
I'm very happy now to welcome Oliver Prezant. He is music director and conductor of the Santa Fe Community Orchestra and lecturer for the Santa Fe Opera, and Pat McEwen, who is with the Santa Fe Opera Guild. And we're here to talk about the Opera Guild's Opera 101, which is a two-part course for opera novices. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Always a pleasure.
Good to have you both back. So you are teaching this two-part course. What are some of the things that you'll actually be teaching that will help people to understand what the heck is going on the first time they go to the opera?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, and I think that's the kind of question that many people have in their mind when they're thinking about the opera, which is such a big part of Santa Fe's culture. And at the same time, people might feel like, oh, gee, I don't know enough to go to the opera, or I wish I could learn more about opera, but I don't want to take a course or something. And this is a really easy way to develop a little bit of a background, enough of a sense of what goes on, get some of the vocabulary, get some examples. And, you know, clearly there's a lot of information on the internet nowadays. There's a lot of information. You can go to a lecture, you can buy a book, you can do all kinds of things, you can get CDs. But when you're talking about opera generally, a 400-year-old art form, it's nice to have somebody to take you by the hand and say, hey, look, this is all a bunch of stories that have been set to music, and you'll recognize them when you see them. And then they get dressed up, depending on the culture they come from, depending on the time that they were written in, depending on the director's feeling this time around when he's working on this opera. So there's a lot of tradition, there's a lot of innovation, but mostly opera is a really familiar storytelling form that has some fantastic music in it. And when someone says, you know, I'd like to learn more about opera, what's the first thing to do? This could be the answer to that question. Opera 101.
So you're really approaching it as much through the theater as the music.
Well, it's got to be both, because really an opera is a story. It's not musical theater, and it's not quite theater with music. It's its own art form, for sure. Let's take a simple situation, such as a girl loves a soldier. That's played out over the centuries in many different ways. You know, in a romantic opera from the 1830s, that might be the melodic experience of a lifetime where the characters are relatively unimportant. They're stock characters. But you go a little later, and it's Carmen, and it's a gypsy girl and a French soldier, and it's hot, hot, hot. And it's starting to be closer to reality, and people are getting stabbed. And then you move a little later, and it's the 20th century, and the soldier is coming apart. His captain doesn't like him, and his mistress, she's not even his wife, is fooling around with the drum major from his own regiment, and he's literally fragmented as a personality. And so you can have this...
Which one is that?
That's Wozzeck. That one's actually going up this summer at the Santa Fe Opera. But really the point is to take, you know, you can take one little idea like that and look at it as it plays out over the centuries and say, wow, look at the different musical treatment. Look at the different context in which you find yourself. I mean, once upon a time, opera was the entertainment of royalty. So royalty always came out looking pretty good in those operas. But then as you get into the 19th century, suddenly it's for a more popular audience. Well, how do you bring a more popular audience in? You know, it's got to be more waltzes, more tunes, more dance numbers, more big choral numbers on stage that are going to show what's going on. And of course, all of that even depends on what country it's coming from. So some of the things that we'll explore in Opera 101 are really, why is French opera different from German opera? Why is German opera from Italian opera? And Italian opera is, you know, that's the defining moment. Opera begins in Italy about 400 years ago.
This is very interesting what you said about when opera moved from being only the entertainment of royalty to a larger audience, presumably the rise of the middle class during the 19th century and all of that, bigger audience. Did they demand more realism?
Well, at first, it's not a question of realism, I think. At first, it's really a question of what's going to bring people into the house. And that means stories about an average person or an average situation. Like, here's an opera from the 1830s, La Sonnambula. It's a ridiculous story. A woman is sleepwalking at night in a little town in Italy. Nobody knows that it's their next-door neighbor. Now, this is already hard to imagine. They think it's some disembodied spirit. So they're terrified by the specter. It's just an excuse for great singing. It's a period of time in opera when singing was so exalted. It's called bel canto, beautiful singing, literally. And so you move from there into things that are much more dramatic. You know, a few years later you have Giuseppe Verdi, who's really like the soul of his nation as it's being formed, and the stories are really dramatic and really tragic. I mean, he didn't write a comedy until the very, very end of his life. So towards the end of the 19th century, things really become kind of realistic. And there's an Italian term for that even, verismo, which means it's the truth. It's reality. It's like a reality show. Opera became a reality show.
Only and probably a little more real.
A little more or a little less. I don't really know how to say it, but I think opera was the primary entertainment. You know, when you thought of what is there to do for hundreds of years, it was the number one art form. So another aspect of this program that we'll do is really to take some of the lingo that may be a stumbling block for somebody. Like, what's an aria? Well, an aria is pretty easy to figure out. It's basically a song that someone sings, or a bit of music that an individual sings in an opera versus a duet. You know, you can figure that one out pretty easily. But recitativo is a concept that, when you look at it, recit, recite, then it's closer to understandable. And again, that little moment where you can relax about something and say, oh yeah, in a Broadway show, they chat with one another and then they sing. But in a lot of opera, they don't do the talking part as if they were speaking. They
right.
do the talking part as if it's a little sing-songy, speech, singing kind of an experience. And so you have a very different manner of communicating. And then frequently the aria is the moment of great personal expression that reveals someone's character and reaction to a situation.
Whereas the recitative moves the action along, but isn't necessarily in itself the great music.
Right. So again, in Opera 101, you're really looking for this defining concept that is a lot of what opera is made of. And of course, all of these things change over time, and so it gives people a chance to really contrast and compare just enough to feel comfortable saying, yeah, I think I'll go in there. I mean, look, anybody walking into the opera house nowadays, there's probably a 300-year, you know, period where the opera may be coming from three centuries of repertoire that's accumulated. And so if you know a little bit about where the composer is coming from, what the context he's writing in, and where the fun of it is, where the joy of it is, you know, you can say to yourself, well, okay, a guy and his girlfriend have a fight and he stabs her and that's the end of the opera. But there's a lot of singing that's going to go on before you get to that point. And some of those things are real traditions. You know, some of the things that you hear in opera are the tradition of two baritones singing together. Baritone is almost the lowest voice. Bass, you know, is a lower voice than a baritone. But two baritones singing together is a comic moment. One baritone is often the bad guy. But two singing together can be a funny thing. And there are certain traditions.
And that's just a tradition. There's nothing inherent about that.
Well, it's, you know, something that developed. And you know, opera takes all kinds of forms. There's comic opera. There's serious opera. There's opera that's kind of in between. And there's opera that's based on mythology. So when someone says, I don't like opera, it's like saying, I don't like life. I mean, just pretty much everything happens in opera, from, you know, crazy rituals to simple love stories.
Well, as your website says, lust, revenge, greed, murder, beheading, suicide, weird druid rituals, and cross-dressing. Like, don't expose your kids to this.
Well, I think, you know, the marketing department went wild there. And they picked...
Actually, that was me.
Oh, that was Pat. She finally fesses up. Well, I mean, those are some pretty extreme things. But, you know, to cut to the chase, most often an opera is about love. And it's about some kind of passion that one person has for another. So you can talk about all the other stuff.
Well, that's what most TV is about, and that's what most movies are about, too, unless they're super action movies. We haven't really gotten into car chase action operas, at least not yet.
Well, I'm sure that's coming.
But you do have cars on stage.
Yeah, for example, we had a, talking about a girl who loves a soldier, there was an opera from, the early part of the 19th century, and it's called The Elixir of Love.
Or that was so great.
Oh, you saw it. Terrific.
That was one of my favorites because the staging of it was so brilliant. They set it in what kind of World War II era setting with...
Just after World War II.
Yeah, yes. With billboards and a guy fixing his car and this great car on stage.
Yeah, the tenor was fixing his car. I mean, how many tenors fix their own cars? I don't know. That's a good subject for a dissertation, I'm sure.
Well, you know, the thing... I mean, okay, I'm going to do my own fessing up, which is that I... hated all opera until I started doing this show and we started talking about opera every year with Desiree Mays, which we're going to do again this year. She writes a wonderful book every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera. And what I found actually going to the opera every year four or five times and listening to it and watching DVDs and so on is that it turns out that once you get into it even a little bit, you don't hate opera. You just hate some operas. And you come to love other ones.
Yeah.
I don't think I will ever like Don Giovanni, mainly because every single character in it is loathsome in one way or another. But The Elixir of Love and, well, La Boheme happening this year and La Traviata are so good that you can't even believe that you're alive seeing this. It's so amazing.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think when it all goes together and you really... can relax and let it come to you. And if you have that little insider feeling about it, like, you know, this opera's not about the plot, this one's really about the singing. Or in this opera, the libretto, which is, you know, all the words that are going to be set to music. The libretto is a little booklet, right?
It's the script.
It's the story, basically. But sometimes the libretto is really tight. And the poetry in the libretto is fabulous. And the imagery in the libretto. And La Boheme's an opera that really exhibits a high degree of coherence of story. And at the same time, the way the music is set is so marvelously appropriate, fantastically imaginative, and it's heart-wrenching. You know, and you have a very powerful experience like that if the staging is good, and then the costumes are good, and then the singers are good. And then the lighting is good. And then you're really thinking about opera as a total art form. You know, you can read the stage. You can read the words. You can read the costumes.
And
sometimes.
You get to read the words because there's subtitles.
Right, that's true. Now, in Opera 101, we'll have some handouts. We'll have some excerpts to contrast and compare. And the first part of it is really, it's down to collected works. And it's an opportunity to just get together and talk about opera, listen a little bit, look at the text. We have some things on exhibit that the opera will provide, you know, a beautiful costume and such. But we'll look at some of the terms, some of the structure, some of the history, and it's very lighthearted. It's very easy to digest. You know, I can't tell you how many people have said to me over the years, I've been lecturing at the opera for, I don't know, 13 years or so. And people come up and they say, you know, I'm embarrassed to say I don't know anything about opera. And I say, well, why should you be embarrassed to say that? And it's one of the mother art forms. You don't necessarily, it doesn't come with the set, you know what I mean? If you didn't grow up with it or if somehow you didn't find your way into the opera house, there's a little... perhaps a need for an icebreaker.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, well, people think it's this elitist art form, and you can say it is, and people point to the ticket prices and so on, but I have to say, first of all, aren't there opportunities to go to dress rehearsals?
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. And in any case, you can go standing room there. You know, there's a way, if you really want to do it, there's a way you can get in without completely breaking the bank. But once you do, what's amazing about it is, especially with the title, you know, the I call them subtitles, I know that's not the right word, but with the English translation going across the screen in front of you, and with the incredible acting that so many opera singers are capable of these days, and the real typecasting that they do, it's so accessible that it's really surprising if you've never been into it before.
That's really true. And, you know, a couple of things. One is that there are tickets that are priced, you know, under $30, or if you buy a subscription, you know, you're really able to get into the opera house and see all of the operas for a very reasonable price. At the same time, the accessibility, what you're talking about in terms of being able to understand the plot, to be able to understand the aria line by line, is dramatically improved. I mean, we have one of the state-of-the-art opera houses here in Santa Fe, where there's a little screen on the back of every seat, and you can watch the screen, watch the stage, and you get the sense of it.
And you know exactly what they're saying. It makes a huge difference.
Right. And, you know, for some people, opera used to be, you know, the spouse wants to go to see the opera, and the other one is sleeping because it's in a foreign language, and you read that opera synopsis in the program book, and it's, you know, some of them are bewildering. You know,
wacky even.
Well,
bewildering and wacky, or, as you say, really simple. Boy meets girl, girl gets stabbed, the end.
Well, it's hard for them to be simple because it's the Hamlet problem. You know, someone said, well, if Hamlet had killed his uncle early on, the play would be over and, you know, we would be at a loss for the greatest, you know, English drama. But at the same time, you look at an opera and you think, well, you're going to have a pretty high-level soprano on stage. Maybe you want her to sing more than one or two times.
Right, and she's got to die slowly and there's got to be a lot of drama. Well, but okay, so all of this is Opera 101. We're talking to Oliver Prezant and Pat McEwen, who has been very quiet, but I want to let people know that there's something very interesting, which is the first part will be at Collected Works Bookstore, and then the second part will be at the Santa Fe Opera. What's going to happen when the group goes up to the opera?
Well, there'll be a chance to meet with some of the production people.
We're very fortunate to have people who've been involved with the opera for years. For example, we had the prop master last year who told some fabulous stories, and he brought some of the props that were used and were going to be used in the summer productions. So.
And it's a chance for people who may live in Santa Fe but have never actually been up at the opera. It's just an extraordinary experience. We'll be in the ranch one of the days and the other day in Stearin Hall, and then perhaps have a chance to do a little creative work of our own.
Exactly. Well, that's the good part, I think, because, you know, if you're going to feel a sense of comfort in the opera house and ownership of the medium, what better way than to, you know, get your feet wet trying to write a little bit of dialogue, for example.
But this is in groups, so yeah. People shouldn't be afraid of it. Last year, I believe there was a one-act opera set in Lithuania called Find the Cheese.
Well, Pat, I don't know if you're doing that justice, but... No, I mean, really, let's look at it this way. If you have a line of text and you explore how to say it in different ways, that's a good theater exercise. But when I'm up there saying, hey, which is the word that we should really exalt by making it longer? What's the pacing of this line given the situation that we've created? And, you know, truth be told, we do have a few costumes and...
Props.
It's not mandatory that you put them on, but that's what's going to happen.
No, it's a lot of fun, really, and people come up with some hilarious ideas that rival some of the wackiest operas that Pat and I have seen.
Well, all of this is happening, Opera 101, in the first 2 weeks of March, and for more information, people can go to opera101santafe.com. Oliver Prezant is the music director and conductor of the Santa Fe Community Orchestra. He lectures for the Santa Fe Opera. Pat McEwen is with the Santa Fe Opera Guild. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.